Morning, gentlemen.
Morning, Assessor.
Two preliminary matters. I'm told, Your Honor, that we are the first to argue before you as the new chief, and I...
Don't do anything that I don't know how to handle.
I doubt that will happen. I hope that this little bit of flattery makes my life a little easier today. The second piece of, the second matter of preliminary matter with regard to the argument today is that I'm going to do very little in terms of direct presentation. I imagine that the court will have questions, and I'm going to leave substantial time for those questions. It's a fairly concise story, and I don't think the parties are very far apart on what the facts are. The co-defendant in this case, Nathan Peek, a sports agent, had several properties in Silver Spring, Maryland, and wanted to refinance them. This was during the halcyon days of the 2006-2007 mortgage bubble and housing bubble, and he enlisted the help of the appellant, a government accountant, Greg McCormick.
Halcyon must mean something different to you than it does to me.
Well, at least by appearance in 2000.
Wild West, heyday, something, okay. I'm sorry, proceed.
Surely. He enlisted the help of the appellant, Mr. McCormick. Now, Peek only had two small problems with regard to a mortgage. One, he had a terrible credit rating, and two, he had not paid any federal taxes in 10 years. But
can I interrupt? No, as I understand it, was it Mr. Hart who told him that this letter that he was going to use, the mock letter, he so called it, that it came from a client's file, right?
Is that That's correct.
Now, why can't a reasonable juror infer from that that we're dealing with a real person? And right, that's all that we need to find here is a reasonable inference. We don't need to find the best inference, just a reasonable inference. But what would be unreasonable about a juror inferring that that was a real person?
Well, I think if you look at that in the context of the dealings between the parties, there was a whole host of things explored, a whole host of strategies. This was a stated income, no doc loan, as it was called back then. And the key issue was furnishing employment verification. Peek was self-employed and needed to furnish not really income verification, because that was established by virtue of forms he had filled out, but the fact that he had a job and was self-employed. A variety of vehicles were examined. One of them was that McCormick had sent over draft tax returns that he had apparently filled out for 2004-2005 with the express condition that Hart not use these in connection with the loan application. And the clear implication from this and the inference was that this was a vehicle that could easily be traced as false. This was something subject to ready verification. Lenders frequently require that borrowers fill out forms allowing them to access the IRS directly. There are many ways that this could be verified, and then the game would be up. There would be clearly a trail of fraudulent behavior. Hart countered with the CPA letter and said that he had gotten it from someplace that had never been used, apparently, in connection with the transaction.
Not from someplace.
From a client.
A client.
Right. Now, you have to remember that Mr. Hart was somebody who had come out of 10 years of a federal drug conviction, and at that point naturally transitioned into the mortgage business. And
during the halcyon days.
They were the halcyon days. The good old days, as we like to call them. And Hart was clearly not above anything in terms of placing a mortgage or below anything. And he crafted a vehicle, or he sent over to McCormick a vehicle that he called the mock letter, a mock letter. It had the name of a CPA, a suburban CPA. It had an address. It had various identifying information. And that's not argued, that the information was properly what the statute considers to be identifying information. Hart had...
And of a real person.
That's right. Those elements are... In fact, the CPA came in to testify as a real person. And it's in that way, it's not unlike Villanueva Sotelo and Flores Figueroa. They were real people. The important part in this case is that the defendant had no reason to believe or to know that they were real people.
And that's the story that you've described would be a perfectly reasonable one for a jury to infer. But what is unreasonable about a jury to infer the other story? And the only part that matters here, as far as I understand, is whether McCormick had reason to know that Brown was a real person. That's it, as far as I mean, that's it. That's the whole
And the argument case. Here.
And why is that an unreasonable inference?
Well, in terms of, had Brown been a royal person, then what you would be doing is you would be giving real information to a lender who only had to make a phone call that was totally beyond your control.
But if you're talking about how quick it is to find out that it's a fraud, that takes two steps. You have to call, you have to find the Mr. Brown, call, and talk to him. If Mr. Brown didn't exist at all, that would take one step. You would Google J. Arthur Brown and Associates and find nothing. So on your theory, which is that it was harder to detect if you used a false person, it seems to me a jury could easily conclude that it was harder to detect if you used a real person. Because a real person, to detect a fraud, would require actually getting through to the real person and asking them, while a fraud would be immediately clear when you found out there was no J. Arthur Brown.
I think you would have found out you couldn't reach J. Arthur Brown. And
you would have found there was no J. Arthur Brown.
Call that firm and it's not there.
Or in this case, would be there. If there was a if that person was fictitious and you called, you would get no answer.
But if the phone number wasn't accurate,
right,
and it said, you know, Domino's Pizza, you would immediately know that this was a fraud.
Not necessarily. You would probably call the borrower and say, I tried to call, an underwriter would probably call and say, I can't get hold of this guy. I dialed this number. Is this the correct number? I think that's a more likely scenario than to just assume that the number you've been given is a total fraud. At that point, at least, the borrower has the option to walk away.
Well, the borrower has the option to walk away in either circumstance.
Well, it's a little bit more. I'm sorry. It's a little bit more problematic when you verify the fact that there's no IRS returns filed, if that's the vehicle that's chosen, and you recall that McCormick was adverse to that kind of use of tax returns. That would have sufficed clearly.
But there was no verification going on at all at that time.
I'm sorry,
there?
Sir.
There wasn't any verification going on in making these loans at all. There was nothing to.
Well, we know that now.
Think about that.
It's a little unclear what borrowers knew back then. They knew what lenders. Or lenders' representatives probably told them about borrowers were not professional borrowers, so to speak. They were one and done, or maybe a couple and done, and then probably relying heavily on what the lender or the lender's representative, in this case, Hart was what they called a bird dog for a registered mortgage broker, finding people who wanted loans. The reliance would generally be on what that person would tell you. I mean, we've seen that over and over again in terms of borrowers who were likely misled in terms of what they should put down on particular forms. In this case, McCormick's entire mode of operation was he was not adverse to filing a fraudulent mortgage application. That's clear from the totality of the conduct. It is clear also that he wanted to do it in a way that would not allow easy and direct detection.
And that's why I'm asking. I agree that the jury could think that that was what was going on here. And the question is, why couldn't a reasonable jury believe that the best way that McCormick thought to avoid detection was to use a real person's name rather than a fake name, that is, the name of somebody who didn't exist at all?
Well, in that way, it's similar to Villanueva's Sotelo. You have to use a number that at least appears to be a real number. You can't just go to a random digit table and make up an alien registration number. Anyone would know who's familiar with those numbers that can't be a real number. It's like Social Security numbers. They have a certain pattern and rhythm that give location and geography and things like that. They can't be a total fabrication. And even in those cases, knowing that that number must be a real creation or a variable of such creation, if the defendant did not know and did not have the necessary mens rea that it went back to a real person. In this case, there was no evidence that either Hart or the defendant ever dealt or knew the existence of uh, of James.
But Hart testified that he did know.
No, Hart testified he had no dealings with
Brown?
Mr. Brown. That's right.
He didn't testify that he knew, that Hart knew?
No, absolutely not. He had no contact with him. He didn't know who he was. He had never dealt with him personally. The only thing he knew about it was that the name came to him through a letter from a...
Didn't he testify that he believed Brown was a real person?
Well, he speculated about what he believed, but that was just pure speculation. That would hardly be the basis for which to...
I'm not saying it's enough to by itself, but you said that Hart didn't know, and Hart says he did believe he was a real person, right? That is what he testified to.
What Hart believed is irrelevant to what McCormick obviously believed.
I appreciate that, but you began by saying that Hart didn't, and I take at least that part is off the table. Hart did, right? Didn't Hart testify?
I want to be clear. Hart said he had a suspicion or he believed. That was never communicated to McCormick. So I didn't think I remember directly, I think it's in my brief, that Hart did speculate that when asked that. It was probably an inappropriate question, but that was not what I was focused on at the time of the trial. But that was just mere speculation on his part. It certainly was nothing communicated to McCormick about Hart's belief. That was something he stated for the first time at trial. And I think that his speculation really sheds very little light on what McCormick might have believed in his mens rea at the time. I've saved a couple of minutes. If the court has any more questions?
Okay, thank you. We reserve remaining time if there is any.
Good morning, and may it please the court. David Rybicki for the United States. Your Honor, the entire correspondence between Hart and the appellant show that both Hart and the appellant were concerned at all times with creating a CPA letter that contained actual data about real people, and they used that data about real people to create false representations in the letter. That was the modus operandi that both appellant and Hart used from the beginning of the creation of the letter, and the emails show that. The first email from Hart from September 29th, 2006, that's Government's Exhibit CE-108. In that email, Hart states that he wanted McCormick to draft the CPA letter. So, and this is before J. Arthur Brown comes into the picture. So we see already that Hart is concerned about having McCormick draft a letter that contains information about Peek's actual CPA. At no point in that email or any other correspondence between appellant and Hart does Hart ever suggest inventing fictitious persona, inventing the names of CPA companies, or inventing any other data. Hart was always concerned with including real means of identification of real people in the letter. That's why he asked McCormick to include the name of Peek's actual CPA. Now, McCormick does not respond for several days. So on October 4th, Hart writes him again, another email, and says, well, here's an example, a mock letter that I used with another client. And at trial, Hart explained that he had obtained the letter from Mrs. Thomas. Hart did not draft the letter. Hart obtained it from a client, another client, as he states in the email. And that letter, that was the J. Arthur Brown letter, that is the so-called mock letter that Hart supplies to McCormick as a template or a draft upon which McCormick should base his letter. Hart says, this is a draft, essentially. You should write a letter that contains the following information so we can have a similar CPA letter for Peek that contains information about Peek's actual CPA, a real person who exists. Again, McCormick does not respond. He's obviously reluctant to draft the fraudulent letter. So Hart takes it upon himself to do that. And in the third email, 2 days later, on the 6th, Hart drafts the letter which has the blank in it. This is essentially the same J. Arthur Brown letter that was drafted by Mr. Brown for Thomas. And then he puts a blank in the letter, again asking McCormick to add the name of Peek's actual CPA. He doesn't suggest inventing a name. He wants an actual person. And McCormick eventually does communicate the name of the actual CPA firm. There's a typo in the letter. The letter states that the CPA firm is S.S. Taylor. In actuality, it's F.S. Taylor. That was not communicated via email, so the jury could have hypothesized that there was a miscommunication orally over the telephone, but that was a real company. And so at all times, both McCormick and Hart were concerned about giving this letter an appearance of authenticity. It was obviously a spurious appearance of authenticity. But nonetheless, at least a surface appearance that this was a genuine letter from real people. And Chief Judge Garland, as you pointed out, this was not necessarily the most well thought out scheme. Any degree of investigation beyond the most superficial would have revealed the fraud. However, if someone does plug in J. Arthur Brown into Google, J. Arthur Brown's website pops up. And if someone plugs in F.S. Taylor and Associates, the Taylor website pops up. So if there is a marginal advantage that accrues to both Hart and appellant to include actual means of identification of real people in the letter, and that's exactly what they did. The record never reflects any evidence that either of them ever discussed inventing fictitious CPAs or fictitious companies. That simply wasn't in the picture, and there's no evidence to suggest that either of them did that. And so it was reasonable for the jury to infer, based on what Hart told McCormick about the origin of the CPA letter, the original J. Arthur Brown letter, that McCormick would believe J. Arthur Brown to be a real person. Fatima Thomas had no connection with Nathan Peek or his financial misdeeds or whatever Peek was involved in terms of the refinancing. She was an entirely separate individual, an entirely separate client of Hart's. And so it was reasonable for a jury to infer that when Hart told McCormick about the origin of the letter, that McCormick assumed that this client existed, was a real person, and had a CPA who drafted this letter for her, which she in turn gave to Hart. And so Hart's retrieval of the letter when McCormick is not responding to the emails, is, I think, akin to the classic examples of identity theft that the Supreme Court cites in Flores-Figueroa. Essentially, Hart retrieves a discarded letter that was not part of a financial application. That letter contained information about real people, just as the dumpster diver assumes, or the hacker assumes, that when he's fishing for data or rifling through someone's trash, that the data he's going to find actually corresponds to a real person. Hart didn't have to meet J. Arthur Brown to believe that he was a real person. And in fact, Chief Judge Garland, he did testify in the May 23rd transcript at page 58 that he, in fact, believed J. Arthur Brown to be a real person, although he had never met him or spoken with him. Just as the dumpster diver, a jury can infer reasonably, in the vast majority of cases, the dumpster diver does not know, has not met or ever corresponded with the person whose identity he's misappropriating. And that's really analogous to the facts that we have here. And so it was reasonable for a jury to infer that based on the information Hart provided to McCormick, that McCormick believed J. Arthur Brown to be a real person, and that they wanted to use J. Arthur Brown's identity in their letter.
Believing the standard?
Well, the standard is knowing, and knowing applies to the act, possessing the information, and knowing that the person actually existed. So the standard essentially is whether or not McCormick had reason to believe or know that this person existed.
Well, what's the reason to believe part? I thought it was just knowing.
It is to know. Whether he knew this person.
The diver who finds the document that someone has discarded really knows that person exists.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
the dumpster word. Diver finds a document, has somebody else's name and social security number, really knows that that person exists.
It's an inference that the jury has to draw, because the dumpster diver presumably is looking for information about real people. And for example, if the dumpster diver uses that information then to access a bank account or enter a website, then the dumpster diver obviously has not discovered fictitious information. And here we have something that's analogous. We have a letter provided by another client who's not connected to Peek. Hart told McCormick that. This was about a separate financing deal that was unconnected to Peek. So we have a separate situation with people who McCormick would have no reason to think that they did not exist. In fact, Hart told them that these were real people. And so...
Right. But which, well, I'm not sure which way that cuts. The defendant here is not analogous to the dumpster diver, right? He's getting the information from the person who's analogous
in,
to the dumpster
in the,
diver.
Yes, Hart would be the dumpster diver.
And who then tells him this person.
Correct. Correct. So he's a step removed. But the mens rea inference that the jury has to draw is, did McCormick know that this person existed? He doesn't have to actually meet the person or correspond with the person or speak with the person to know that they exist.
Well, I think you were a little closer to the mark your first time to have reason to believe, anyway, that he exists.
I think that's correct, yes. If the panel has no further questions.
Nope. Thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Sussman. Does he have any time left? All right, we'll give you 2 minutes because you noticed that I was the chief judge.
Actually, Mr. Rabicki told me, sir.
I gave him more time, but he didn't use it all up. But I'm going to use part of your time to ask you this question. So what is your answer to his point that when it came to listing the name of the CPA firm that prepared the tax returns, which, of course, didn't actually prepare the tax returns, they used a real name, and the request from Hart was, what is the name of Nate's CPA company? Not, give me a false name, just what is the name? So how does that fit into your theory that the best way to elude detection is to use false names?
Well, in terms of the previous dealing, there was no CPA company that Peek was using for personal income tax. It was clear that the only income tax forms that had been furnished were ones, the drafts that McCormick had
furnished.
Right. So that was false.
That was false, but Taylor was a real company. That is, on your theory, which was that it would be easier to evade detection by using a company that didn't exist at all, that is, as if Brown weren't really a company, why didn't they use a name in the middle of the letter, a company that didn't exist, rather than Taylor? Because if you'd called Taylor, you would have also learned that these returns had never been prepared correctly.
There's no identifying information about Taylor in the letter. I can't really answer why that name was used. Maybe it was the first name that came to him. But everything in that letter was false from a bullet standpoint. McCormick was unwilling to put his name on the CPA letter. That would have been a fairly simple thing to say. I've looked at his tax returns. They appear to be filled out correctly, and they seem to state his income for these years and his employment. He was unwilling to do that, largely, I would surmise, because the trail would come right back to him as knowing that this was false, because he had never done any tax returns or Peek had never filed any tax returns. From everything in that letter was false, and Hart knew everything was false. So the court is taking one that letter head out and saying that a jury could reasonably infer that was true while everything else was false. And to follow up on Judge Ginsburg's point, dumpster diving, all those things that were mentioned in Flores Figueroa, as far as I know, real people throw out trash, real people have bank accounts, real people have all those kinds of identity theft. It's clear that there's a real person at the bottom of that, and the inference is overwhelming with regard to that. The inference is not that in this case.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Mr. Sussman, you're appointed by the court to represent the appellant. We're grateful for your assistance.
Thank you.